Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Dave Plyer's radio special celebrating the 50th anniversary of the TV sitcom Happy Days starts right now.
All right, Dave Plyer, 720 WGN. Welcome in, everybody, to our WGN radio special celebrating the 50th anniversary of classic TV sitcom Happy Days. Debuting in 1974, ABC Television was in search of a replacement series for a low-rated comedy. With the nostalgic theatrical American Graffiti, complete with a clean-cut Ron Howard in the cast, the solution was simple. The tale of a high school student named Richie Cunningham, his family and friends, set in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in the 1950s. The original concept of Happy Days was introduced on ABC's romantic anthology series, Love American Style. Now, filmed in single-camera style, Happy Days finished its first season as ABC's second-highest-rated series. Its overall ranking was number 16, and the eventual breakout star Henry Winkler as the Fonz wasn't even in the opening credits. But by the second season, the decision was made to shift the focus to the Fonz and now film the series permanently with three cameras and an audience, which gave these later seasons a markedly different style and became a hit, climbing to number one and lasted for 11 seasons. Tonight, we'll celebrate with the stars of Happy Days, Marion Ross, Anson Williams, Donnie Most, and the iconic Henry Winkler. First up, Mrs. C, Marion Ross. So before she was affectionately known to millions as Mrs. C on TV's Happy Days, Marion Ross began her career as a Paramount starlet who went on to appear in nearly every major TV series of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And soon came that fateful phone call from producer Gary Marshall that made her an overnight success and changed her life. And to share that journey with us, Marion Ross joins us once again tonight. Marion, how are you?
Well, I am so well. Isn't that extraordinary? I think that's my Midwest, being raised in the Midwest.
I think it is. Very grounded, you are.
Yeah. Well, and we had those tough winters,
you know, in
Minnesota, in Albert Lea, Minnesota.
You did. You absolutely did. And you can honestly say you really did have a pretty happy childhood growing up.
Well, I did, didn't I? I didn't know that, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm the second little girl. I'm the middle child. Mm-hmm. Are you a middle child?
I'm the oldest. Yeah, I'm the oldest out of two.
You're the oldest.
Yeah.
I see. So I sometimes being the middle child, the second little girl, I had to work really hard to get, and then a crippled brother, to get any attention at all.
Yeah.
I had to be so cute, you know?
Yeah. Well, and you were always seeking, and I read this, you were always seeking your dad's attention, right?
I know.
Yeah.
I was aware.
Yeah.
At a very young age that people were watching me. Then I'd get cuter than ever.
Yeah.
You know?
So that's something that really inspired you pretty young, that you wanted to get kind of into this business.
I wanted attention. And yet I'm a very modest person, but I still wanted attention, if you don't mind. If you don't mind, it would be like, look at me.
Yeah.
Will you look at me?
Yeah. Yeah.
I will kill myself up on that stage if you will just watch me.
Yeah.
It's so pathetic. I thought, if I could outgrow that, need.
Well, you know,
I never did.
My daughter's a middle child, and I know that's exactly how she feels sometimes. She really has to wrangle us in to get her attention. She's got a much older brother. She's got a much younger brother. And so that kind So I think I get what you're saying there. And I know when you were younger, too, you didn't really have a TV in the house, but you were very entertained by theater magazines, movie magazines, radio and theater, specifically. But as a young girl in Minnesota, acting was something, and as you said, was something you were always thinking about doing.
Oh yes, but it was the movie. We went to the movies.
Yeah.
But one of the first books, I don't know if you are familiar with Noel Coward. Some people aren't.
Okay.
No. Oh, it's a great English playwright.
Yeah.
Song and dance man. It's fabulous. So one of the first books I would read when I went to the library was his autobiography. And he was like in England, and he was like 6 or 7 years old. starting in show business. I was already 13, 14. So I thought I've got to get going.
Wow, that's awesome. That provided some good inspiration, because I know you also, you know, spent a lot of time in the library too, talking about reading Who's Who's books and trying to understand how people got from where they started to where they were, because you wanted that kick to know what you needed to do to get to that next level.
Yeah. Now all of a sudden they're famous. Well, what happened?
I love that. I love that.
And I love that you've actually read the book.
I did.
My friend. That's wonderful.
I did. Absolutely. Well, I was going to say, you were in the seventh grade production of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. And as you said, your family did move around a lot, and you didn't always find the place that you were living, the atmosphere, that appealing. But you would always find refuge in the movie theater.
Oh, yes. And I would read autobiographies of actors.
Yeah,
but movies, of course, they only change the movie like every 2 weeks.
Right.
So that movie, I would cherish it so much and play it over and over in my head. You know, it was wonderful. Wonderful. Now we are inundated with entertainment,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we are, aren't we? Yeah, there's just too much to choose from.
Too much.
Yeah.
It was terribly special. And the movie magazines, the movie stars in those days, we don't have that anymore,
no,
do we?
No, not that. Maybe on the Oscar night, but not the glamour that really existed back in the day, no.
Yeah, and if you look at those beautiful photographs of the stars, there wasn't a mark that shouldn't be there. It was all retouched. They were perfection. They were gods, you know?
Yeah, they absolutely were back then.
And you know, what's interesting in my book is that I got to work with, I have a picture with Clark Gable. I have a picture with Cary Grant. I
thought the pictures were great in that book. It really kind of told the story of what you were doing, because I was looking at this. You know, you obviously went to study drama at the MacPhail Center of the Arts. You went to San Diego University, and you got married. You moved to Hollywood early on, you know, as you were trying to make it big there in Hollywood, and you eventually got a studio contract at Paramount. You know, you dealt with some struggles, you know, with your husband at the time and alcohol. And you know, having a drink and smoking in the 50s wasn't that uncommon, but this was probably a little over the top.
Oh, no, everybody's smoking.
Yeah.
And because I come from a Scotch Presbyterian father, there was very little drinking, so I wasn't drinking. I didn't think that was going to be a problem for anybody.
Right.
Well, so I found out, didn't I? Yeah.
You did. But, you know, you still, you know, with that said, you still forged forward. You were talking about some of the icons that you worked with, along with Ginger Rogers, William Holden, you know.
Yeah.
And you played an Irish maid very early on. And I love this because, you know, you think about the Brooklyn Bridge days. You played an Irish maid on Life
well,
with
I
Father.
I like doing accents.
Yeah,
I could do an Irish accent, and I like the father. I love that. We did it live at CBS.
Yeah, right.
So with Leon Ames and Lorraine Tuttle live, you know, no mistakes. There it was. So I was always I would love to imitate the way people talked.
Yeah.
If I listened. In fact, I would. When I was like in the third grade, there was a girl that, you know, she had the really cutest small little way of speaking. She just, it was so cute. And I thought, so immediately I imitated that. And the next thing I know, we were both sent to a remedial speech class.
Oh, you know? That's awesome. That's great.
So I snapped out of it right away, but she's there to this day, I suppose.
Yeah, that's cool. No, that's cool. And that was very early television, too. I mean, and I was reading this at Life with Father, even though it was broadcast in black and white, they actually kind of broadcast it in color, but no one had a color TV back then.
I guess.
Yeah.
In fact, when I was at Paramount, everybody, all the big stars were there on the lot. I mean, at lunchtime, Marlene Dietrich would come swooping into the commissary.
Wow.
C.B. DeMille was in this little alcove around the corner. I mean, it was all happening. So it was thrilling.
Well, we're talking to Marion Ross, Mrs. C from TV's Happy Days on the show's 50th anniversary. And there's more with Marion next on 720 WGN.
Well, you know, and then the late 60s, you got divorced. Now you've got kids, you got finances, you know, you got a home to pay for. And you essentially kind of had to start over. And I know you had a friendship with Sandra Gould, who was Mrs. Kravitz from Bewitched.
Yes.
And she kind of told you about this pilot that was happening. And it was The New Family in Town, which was a prelude to Happy Days, of course.
Yes. On Love American Style. Yeah. So I owe her a great deal. And she had me come over for dinner and the casting woman. And simple as that.
Wow. You know? Wow. Amazing how that happens.
But, you know, when I look back at my life, I was helped. I was constantly being helped by people.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah. Yes, good friends. Good friends and great family, too. And, you know, it was really a dream come true because, you know, the 1950s were pretty popular with American Graffiti and the theatrical play Grease, and ABC picked up this show with a slightly modified cast from the original pilot. And then you had Ronnie Howard and Henry Winkler, the late Tom Bosley. What an amazing experience that must have been to get that role.
Well, it was. Of course, we had no idea that it was going to turn into this phenomenal success. It was only after, I think we've been on like a year and a half, and then finally the young producer called us all in. He said, "You've all got to cooperate because we have a hit on our hands."
And you went live in front of a live audience because you were taping that show a little bit more as a one camera kind of show.
Yes.
With a laugh track, and now you're going in front of a live audience when the show really took off. But I think about this now. You mentioned earlier about how much entertainment there is out there to watch, but at that time there were 25 million people every week watching that show.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Now you see the ratings, you get a 5.
Yeah.
Or something. We had 22. We always got, everybody was watching Happy Days, and then they would go to school and talk about the show.
Yeah.
The night before.
Yeah, it's all water cooler.
You're a wonderful interviewer.
Oh.
Young man.
Well, thank you, Marion. Thank you, dear. Thank you. Well, and I was looking at this, 11 seasons, 254 episodes. You know, it was an iconic show. Time and time again, you've been voted one of TV's favorite moms. That's got to be a very cool thing.
It's a very comfortable feeling. No matter where I go, there is somebody that will come up to me and say something so nice to me. I'm very appreciative of all of that. Yeah.
Sure. Ron Howard wrote the foreword to your book, which I found apropos because in this book, you know, you talk about the early days in your life. I love the way this book kind of flows. And you talk about the people who were special in your life almost by chapter. And it's kind of a Q&A that goes through people talking about their experiences with you. So you get Henry Winkler, you get Donnie Most, you get Anson Williams, Scott Baio, and of course, your children. I thought that was very well done, and people
and my personal assistant too.
Yeah, Gwen.
She wrote a chapter. Gwen.
Yeah, Gwen. Yeah, yeah.
So it's a it's fun, and now it's coming out. So I can move on, right? I think I can enjoy my retirement.
Yes, you absolutely. Yeah, and I know that you. But you know, before you did all that, you did Brooklyn Bridge. You were Drew Carey's mom on the Drew Carey Show, Nurse Jackie, Grey's Anatomy, The Middle.
Oh God!
Right. I mean, you know, you deserve to take a little respite now and enjoy yourself without having to go on one more audition, right?
Absolutely, and it's funny. That you do get satisfied, and I'm very willing to quit. You know, very willing. I don't mind one bit. I said,
And somebody will say, oh, look at what one of your pals is doing. I'll say, good, good for her.
I love that. I love that.
Go get them.
Go get them. Go get them. Marian, you know, you were one of my first interviews, and I have to say, it is always a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you so much. I love talking to you, honey. It's just wonderful.
Thank you. Thanks so much. All right, bye-bye now. It's 720 WGN.
Dave Plyer's radio special, Happy Days at 50. Continues.
Anson Williams starred in the 70s sitcom for all 11 seasons as Richie Cunningham's best friend, Patsy Weber. He's also a respected director and producer, and he joins us in studio. Welcome in, Anson.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. How did you get the role on this iconic series?
Well, it's a long story, the road on Happy Days. I don't think people realize that there were two pilots.
Yeah, right.
And the first one didn't have a Fonzie.
No.
And didn't have a Ralphie. And didn't have a Tom Bosley.
No.
And didn't have an Aaron Moran. No. It had Marion, Ron, and I.
Harold Gould.
Harold Gould played the father. Yeah. But it was a softer show. It was more like Summer of 42. You know, it was a year before American Graffiti. And they were really desperate in casting the Patsy character. I mean, I was going down to audition the day before fittings and then shooting the next day. That's how tight it was. So I got the call to audition. And I never really auditioned for a pilot before. So I go, great. I'm in my car on my way down. It's pouring rain. And my car stalls. Oh. And back then, they didn't have cell phones, anything.
Right.
You schlepped to a payphone.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I'm like drenched. I'm just drenched.
Yeah.
And I call up the auto club.
Yeah.
Right? Come get me. Well, it's going to be a few hours. We're swamped.
Oh, okay.
So I go, oh, God. So I get back to the car. And I mean, it's like I took a shower. And I'm this old Corvair, and I'm sitting in there, and I thought, oh God, I didn't call my agent. Well, I'm not walking back out there.
Not to the phone.
Heck. So hours later, they come. It was just a loose wire, or whatever. They get it done, but it's hours after the audition, and I'm thinking, well, I might as well go home. I mean, they've cast it; it's done.
Yeah.
And something said in my head,
yeah,
go get it. Move forward, boy.
Yeah,
and something deep down said, no, they haven't cast it. I don't know why, and I. So I'm 4 hours late, 3 hours late. I get to the studio, I get in, and I hear this voice. Where the hell you been, Millie Gussie, the casting director?
Okay.
I go, I'm this. I was
Millie.
Broken down.
Okay.
I was broken down. I was, you know, I couldn't. She goes, yeah, lucky. We haven't found Patsy yet. I go, what's a Patsy? She goes, read this. So I remember my friend Howie Schertzman. So I just like used his personality for the character. So I read. She goes, stay there. Well, P.S. It goes through. By the time I got home, you know, the phone's ringing, and I'd gotten the part.
Wow.
Okay, I'd gotten
pretty
the part.
Awesome. Yeah.
And we do the pilot.
It was in 71. It was a few years before that. It was a new family in town. So it was kind of a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it wasn't even, you know, I think it was 72.
It was 72?
Yeah, okay. It was the year before.
Okay.
So we do the pilot. It goes, oh, you're just terrific. You're great. Oh, my God. This thing's for sure going to sell. For sure going to sell. I'm already like, ha, this is great.
Yeah.
It doesn't sell.
No.
I go back to concerned boyfriend roles. I mean, it was great.
Yeah.
It was a career. Literally, there'd be a five-page scene. I have five lines.
Yeah.
So, and then I nod a lot. But so anyway, a year later, American Graffiti comes out. And Ron's even starring in it, right?
Yeah.
American Graffiti comes out. I'm doing the show called Lisa Bright and Dark in San Francisco, this Hallmark Hall of Fame movie. I get a call. They're doing another Happy Days pilot because, you know, American Graffiti's popular. The Broadway show Grease is popular. They want to do another pilot. I go, great. When are we shooting? Well, you're auditioning.
Oh.
What?
Really?
What? What do you mean? I created the character. He who owns the gold makes the rules.
Yeah.
They think you and Ron might be too old. What? So now we're down there. Now we've got a screen test.
Because how old are you at the time?
22.
Okay. Yeah.
23.
Okay.
Yeah, 23 at the time. So, and, you know, but we looked like babies.
You're the face, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, but it didn't matter anyway. It's just, you know, corporate stuff. So there's like, you know, 15 pairs of people playing Patsy and Richie. Richie, you know, it's like pretty intimidating. But I go down there the day before for wardrobe fitting, and Ron's there getting wardrobe fitting, and we're doing it together.
Yeah.
And he goes, Anson, I know a lot about this pilot stuff. I said, I know nothing. He goes, no, listen to me. They only give you 20 minutes. He said, I got a hunch. If we can find the set and rehearse ourselves and make up all this stuff, all this cool stuff, and then act like it's spontaneous when we're shooting the test, we'll get longer time.
Brilliant. Okay.
He's brilliant. So Ron directs us in the scene, and we create all these bits, right? And so next morning we're first up, and Gary Marshall's directing the tests, and 20 minutes turned into 2 hours. Oh, I like that. Do this. Oh, that's good. Do this. We started becoming this creative time. And we walk out of there, and you can see all these sullen faces, the other 14 pairs. Yeah. And I'm just smiling going by. But anyway, P.S., we got the part again.
Yeah.
But again, it was moving forward. Ron was smart. We did that extra something. Now, Don Most was actually auditioning for Potsy.
Okay.
But he was so good, they created the role of Ralph for him.
To hang on to
it. Yeah, and then Fonzie was there. You know, a small part. Well, very P.S., you saw the magic happen. And Willie, I remember way back when, I had a problem in high school with football, and I didn't think something was fair. And he said, listen, sometimes there's better ways to get there. There's better ways to get there. Be patient. And sure enough, if we'd have taken the first road with the first pilot, it had gone in air and failed.
Interesting to say that, yeah.
No. We got a better way to get there. Second pilot, how did we get there? We had a Fonzie character. We had Tom Bosley. We had a Ralph character. Better way to get there, hit show.
But they still burned one of those off on Love American Style. Was that the first pilot or the second?
The first pilot. They burned off.
Yeah,
it wasn't made for Love American Style, but they played it off because it was a half hour. You know,
they never got rid of anything.
Love American Style was 10 minutes segments. Yeah,
right. Wow. So, were you shocked that this finally got picked up? You know, after a couple of years of just kind of sitting there, was it kind of like yes, I was patient, I waited, and now here it is for me.
No, I wasn't patient, but no, it was like, wow, great. But it went on the air so fast, and we worked so hard.
Yeah,
you didn't even have time to digest it.
Yeah,
you know, it was a crazy time of 17-hour days,
and the pace was different. I mean, it was single camera. There was
yes.
no audience. It was like Summer of 42, kind of watching. It was like watching a movie every
yeah,
week.
Yeah, it was. Well, it was more like Graffiti now. Yeah. It had a more of a hipper, you know, music tone to it. And it was totally different and a lot of work.
But I mean, out of the box, it was number 16. The next season, it dropped down to 40, like out of the top
48.
30. Yeah, it was 48. And you weren't sure if it was going to be renewed. And I know the answer to this, but tell us what the turning point was.
Well, first of all of us on our own went out and promoted.
You did.
Enough.
On the road. Yeah.
Just to keep it on the air, just to get a chance for third season. Fred Silverman happened to have taken over entertainment at ABC. And Jerry Paris and Gary Marshall thought, if we change the show into three camera, because, you know, Jerry directed Dick Van Dyke. Mm-hmm. Gary was doing The Odd Couple. I mean, there were three camera, you know, geniuses.
Yeah.
They said they think they could work the show into a hit by going live audience. And Fred Silverman agreed, but he said it's very important to put Fonzie forward, move him up to the front. And Ron Howard had a yes or no decision on that. And Ron Howard said, absolutely, better for the show. I'll take a backseat. That's going to make the show. And there we are, 48th place, you know, live audience, first show, people are on their feet, crazy, yelling, screaming. Yeah. That year, we went up to the highest rated show in the history of television, became the number one show in the world, and we became the phenomena.
It was cool to see that episode because, I mean, it was using some of the original set pieces. I think you had it. Didn't they have to move the set to another stage so that you could actually film all of that?
Well, we had the I Love Lucy stage.
Is that what it was?
Yeah. The second Lucy series, same crew, same cameras.
Wow.
You know, there's even a story. There's even a story about that stage in the book.
Yeah. And then, you know, then it took off from there and the rest is history, really.
Yeah. And it's one of those rare moments in time. Here we are 40 years later talking about it.
40 years later talking about
it. But Gary Marshall was such a teacher. He made sure we wore many hats so we'd have lots of tools for our lives, for our careers in show business. And that's why I think everyone's still involved in the entertainment business because we used it, you know, in a very meaningful way. We took it seriously. We were in it. We weren't of it. And we were able to learn directing, writing, and be able to continue our lives in the entertainment business.
Well, we're talking to actor, author, and TV director Anson Williams, and there's more right after this on 720 WGN. So we just talked a little bit about how Happy Days got off the ground, and I have to tell you, what a legendary cast that you worked with, and great people. I've had a chance to talk to Henry Winkler. I actually taught a class with him up at Marquette University on the history of television, and I've interviewed Marion Ross. I mean, such great people to work with.
Oh, it was just one of those rare combinations of people. And, you know, and the real, maybe the major reason for the evergreen part of Happy Days is because of the people. There's something about our personalities and our chemistry that is bigger than the page. You know, it's just, it's an it factor that you can't write. And it just happens rarely. But when it does, it's magic. It's, I mean, Happy Days crossed over every culture.
Yeah, it does.
They knew nothing about the 50s.
Yeah.
But they related to the characters. There was something that connected with the human race.
Yeah, and it's pretty timeless as well. You wrote in the book, too, about Gary talking to you about baseball in
yes.
the beginning of the show to see if you were a player. And
yeah.
obviously, he had in mind, from a leadership perspective, how to keep people grounded and how to get people to work as a team, maybe kind of outside of their normal element. I thought that was awesome.
Well, Gary is a sports nut.
Yeah.
And honestly, he wanted a softball team so he could play all the major stadiums in pre-K charity games.
That's brilliant.
And we're auditioning. He wants to know, do you play ball?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Do you play ball? Oh, yeah, it was pretty good. I was in Little League All-Star game. He goes, what position? I go, first. He goes, I'm first. I play first. I said, but I'll show. He goes, how are you in outfield? Whatever you want, Gary.
Yeah, right.
So he put together a softball team.
Yeah.
And our greatest memories are those games, are those experiences. We played in Germany. We played in Japan.
I was here when you played at Wrigley.
We played at Wrigley.
79.
We played every major stadium. Yeah. I mean, and it really did make us closer.
Henry didn't play.
Henry did play.
But he didn't at first.
At first, no.
You guys taught him how to play.
Yes, yes,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah.
Well, Don could have been a professional. Don Most. Ron was
Is that
great.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was pretty good. And we had a great, we had some of the crew were amazing. They came with us.
What was the turn? What was the point for you, Anson, where you knew the show was huge? Like, what was that moment that you said, "Holy cow, this is big"?
Well, there were a couple of moments. I mean, from the get-go, it was big with the teenage crowd, and that was just mind-blowing. I mean, we had no idea till the first personal appearance.
I had an Aaron Moran poster in my room. I'm pretty sure.
It was. You know, they teach you. They teach you how to act and your craft.
Yeah.
There should be a class on how to deal with fame.
Yeah,
how do you deal with that kind of fame?
Right.
60 million people a week, up to 68 million people.
Yeah.
You know, and Henry Winkler was the number one star in the world.
Yeah, but when you guys just walked out on stage, the audience was screaming.
Yeah.
Before you even spoke, that's how hot that show
was. Yeah, it was, it became apparent where, you're everywhere.
Yeah.
And everybody knows you and all that. But at the same time, all of us lived a life to kind of, actually back then, the paparazzi and all that, they weren't as, they didn't cross the line very much. Uh-huh. They didn't go where you lived. They didn't, you know, so basically if you went to them, it was, you know, you had to deal with it and it's fine. But they didn't come to you. So you could actually kind of create a life for yourself, as popular as it was.
Sure.
These days, boy, I don't know. It's just, it would be really difficult to have that privacy.
That fame isn't as big as it was back then because there was only three channels.
Right.
And so, you know, the exposure that you had was so different. Now, you also talked about in the book, and another inspirational moment from Willie, you know, you wanted to kind of expand what you were doing with the show even. And you went to Gary and said, you know, I sing.
Oh, well, when I was 15... The first year I was working there at Leonard's Department Store, we're unpacking refrigerators in the appliance department, and way back. And the big deal was you had these refrigerators, and when you opened the little freezer in them, there was no ice.
Okay.
Your food was without chopping away at rice and all that.
Yeah.
So we're unpacking them, and I tell Willie, freeze your food, not your freezer. And he goes, that's good, boy. You got the gift of words. You know,
you
find opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, you got that.
That's some good advertising stuff there.
Yeah, he said you got the gift. You know how to sell. He said you use that proper. Don't use it for bad. You use it for good. You good boy. And 2 days later, there's a banner across the appliance, section.
Yeah,
freeze your food, not your freezer. And I felt so great. I'm good at something.
Yeah.
And they sold a bunch of refrigerators. So that was the beginning of me looking for opportunities. It was kind of my entrepreneurial beginning. And so while we're doing Happy Days, we didn't get paid like stars do today. Nowhere near.
Right.
So I'm looking for opportunity, and it hits me. You know, David Cassidy singing on the Partridge Family. He's got this record deal.
You had a similar record, same label.
Right. Well, what happened? Yeah. And then the Brady Bunch, they're singing. So I said, let's get a band on the show. So I go to I find Gary, and Gary's telling me, I don't have time right now. I'm busy. I go, no, you got to listen to me. He goes, well, walk with me. What? Quick. So I had 60 seconds. It changed my life. I said, you got girls. You got cars. You need a band on Happy Days. You know, remember, I sing, and we can have this band, and Richie could be in it, and Ralphie could be in it.
Well, music was a big part of the show anyway.
Exactly. Yeah, but I mean, we have a band. We can use it. It'd be great for the show. He goes, oh, a band. Yeah. I used to be a drummer. Yeah, I could. That's a good idea. He said, yeah. There's a show coming up, a fraternity party, and the band can play there. Go to Bobby and you pick a song. I like that. I'm going, it just changed my life.
Yeah.
60
right.
seconds.
Yeah.
Then he stops and turns back to me. But you're singing to a bulldog. I go, why? He said, if you're good, I get laughs. If you're bad, I get laughs. You're singing to a bulldog. So there I am singing. I'm all okay. shook up to a bulldog.
Yeah.
But singing to a bulldog. It was much more than...
Metaphorical for you.
Yeah, it was much more than just singing that one song. It opened up a music career on the show. I got signed to the same label as David Cassidy.
Right, right.
I started doing concerts all over the country.
What's the thing? After you tape on Fridays, you were on a plane.
I was on a plane doing a concert somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like I said earlier, jumping the shark is a precise moment when success fails. Singing to bulldogs is a precise moment when you start to climb. And that was the beginning of my climb, real climb
yeah.
in life.
Yeah.
And I thought it was apropos for the title.
I remember when I lived in Minneapolis for a few years, there was a restaurant that opened up in one of the malls called Big Al's. Really great food. I knew you were associated with it, and I also knew it was one of those life lessons for you as well.
Yeah, well, I was always entrepreneurial, always look for opportunity. And with Happy Days, I was thinking back then, wouldn't it be great to have Happy Days cafes? You know, like 50 restaurants. I know nothing about food.
Yeah.
And but I kind of created this concept.
Yeah.
And Al Molinaro came on board with me, who actually owned a collection agency, believe it or not. And he knew something about business. And I had a friend who knew someone at Coca-Cola, and I get if they liked your concept, they would finance free performers if you use Coke when you open.
Makes sense, yeah.
So we got this whole performer, and they brought in like one of the world's leading experts on fast food. He, in fact, owned 31 Hardee's, like just had this whole empire going in fast food.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes in and starts working with us, and finally says, "You know, guys, this is so good. Forget investors." And he says, forget Happy Days. Let's call it Big Al's, because then you don't have to pay Happy Days, licensing or anything.
Yeah.
So let's just us do it. It's too good. I'll come in with you guys. Wow, we got the best guy in the world right here, and Al and I. So sure enough, we throw in the money, and he puts the first one up in Overland Park, Kansas, because in Overland Park Mall, because that's where his offices were.
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough, bam, huge hit. Comes back to us, guys, I got the bank to back us for, we don't have to put in a dime. They're going to back us for 9 more. Whoa, man.
Yeah.
Great. Now, Al and I know nothing about the restaurant business at the time. We don't know what we're getting into, but we know, oh my God, he's so
business
big.
Business is a learning experience all the way around, my friend. I understand.
Oh, but this guy's, how could we lose? This, you know, and Willie used to say, look too perfect, talk too perfect, you look inside, boy. You look inside, boy. Well, I didn't, that lesson came like a little late, later when it, so anyway, now we have 10 restaurants. Boom, bang, bang, huge hit. Now, no money's coming to us because the guy's saying, oh, we're putting the money back in. Then he goes, guys, got this, let's franchise. Bam, 10 franchises, 20 restaurants in like just over a year. What? I go, hey, I'm a restaurant, we got 20 restaurants, not a dime.
Yeah.
And guess what? And it's going, and we just show up and smile.
Great food, by the way. I remember.
Yeah.
It was great food.
It's great food. And then one day we get this little thing in the mail. It's a bankrupt notice from that first partner, who happened to be sociopathic, alcoholic, prescription drug addict, gambleaholic, and was taking all the money out to feed his other situation.
To fund himself.
So all of a sudden, guess who's responsible with all the mall leases and everything, and the bank and everything? Al and myself.
Yeah.
You want to talk about a PhD in business?
Yeah, that was it.
We ended up losing everything we put in it. But we didn't lose our houses, thank God. Someone came in, we were able to like sublease. And,
Yeah, right.
It was a lesson in life, entrepreneurially, never, ever go into a business that you don't know about.
We are talking to actor, author, and director Anson Williams, and there's more after the news next here on 720 WGN. There were so many notable guest stars, Anson, on the show. Tom Hanks, Robin Williams, Cheryl Ladd, Frankie Avalon.
You know who else visited us on the set? Ringo Starr.
Ringo. You even had Ringo on there.
But you didn't put Pat O'Brien.
Pat O'Brien was there too.
He played a part.
Right. He did.
Danny Thomas.
Who played Howard's father? Was it Danny Thomas?
Yeah. Okay. No.
Or was that Pat O'Brien?
I think Pat O'Brien played Howard. Yeah. That was amazing.
But there was one episode, and I do want you to share a little bit of this story, about Robin Williams. And he wasn't the first guy chosen to play Mork. You guys saw the script for this Mork episode. You were all pretty like, what is this?
The script, you know, Gary and his son, Scotty, who was 10 at the time, saw Star Wars. And Scotty asked his dad to do a Martian episode.
Yeah.
You know, and his family.
Okay.
Yeah, it was the worst script ever. I mean, we were so proud of the material we would get.
Absolutely.
This was like horrible.
Yeah.
And just, anyway, we couldn't believe we were doing this thing. So they hired some actor, and Monday we're rehearsing, Tuesday we're rehearsing, Wednesday we're rehearsing. It's horrid. Thursday's camera blocking day. It's mechanical. And Friday you're shooting it with an audience.
Yeah.
After a quick run through. Yeah. So Wednesday's the last really rehearsal. That night the actor quits, and I didn't blame him. He looked terrible. He quits. Yeah. Gary comes down to the set and says, "Anybody know a funny Martian?" Al Molinaro says, "Hey."
Yeah, was that?
There's this funny guy in my Harvey Lembeck improvisational class, Robin Williams. And then Ronnie Hallen, who was Gary's sister, says, "Oh, yeah, here he's funny. All right, bring him down." So the next morning, it's camera blocking day. There's never a writer on the set. It is just mechanics. I'm in a little later because I'm not in the first few scenes. I get on the set. You can hear a pin drop. There's every writer.
Yeah.
Writing like crazy. Jerry Paris comes up to me. He's a genius. He's a genius. He's a genius. What?
Yeah.
And I watch this Robin Williams creating the whole character, improving the entire script. And the writers are desperately writing down this genius.
Yeah.
Nanu, standing on his head, the whole enchilada.
Yeah.
That was that was Thursday. By Friday night, it was one of the best shows in the history of television.
Yeah.
The audience is going crazy.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. Would Robin have ever had the opportunity to be all he could be in any other part? He would never be 100% if he had to play anything he wasn't. He had this platform to be the God-given gift he is of the world.
Even when I've watched that episode, I've noticed all of you almost like watching him.
Oh.
It's very noticeable that you're all kind of like in awe a little bit of what was going on.
I've never worked with a performer like that. And the kindest, gentlest, wonderful human being on earth.
Great to hear. Thanks for hanging out with us for so long tonight.
So much fun.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
It was great. Thanks for sharing those stories.
You bet.
All right. Have fun when you're in town.
I will.
All right. Much more ahead at 720 WGN. All right. We are celebrating the 50th anniversary of TV sitcom Happy Days. And up next is the actor who played Ralph Melf. And that is Donnie Most. Welcome in, Donnie.
Oh, thanks. Good to be here.
So glad you're here. When was the last time you were in Chicago? You were probably doing some jazz, some standards, some something here.
That's exactly right. I think about 3 years ago at Andy's Jazz Club.
Yeah.
And I did sort of a guest stint with the Chicago Jazz Orchestra, and it was a blast. I had a great time. And then I was on WGN on the TV, you know, Morning News.
Morning News, yeah.
Probably about 2 years ago, a year ago, and I got to do, they had a big band also called Big Band Boom, and I did a Christmas song, so that was awesome. Fun. Yeah.
That's awesome. I think Anson came on and did Splish Splash some years ago.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, I remember the producer, Jeff, telling
me. Hoover.
Jeff Hoover,
absolutely. I'm a big TV geek. I've had your fellow cast members, Henry Winkler, Marion Ross, Anson Williams on the show. Marion Ross was the only one that said the F word on the air to me, by the way. We had to bleep that out at some point. Probably doesn't surprise you.
But it might have surprised you. Right?
It did surprise me a little bit. But they all agree, too, that the cast of that show was such a family.
Yeah, you know, and it sounds kind of cliche, oh, we're family, but it really was the case. We got along just famously and on a professional level and a personal level, and it was a great bringing together. You know, you have to give the casting director, but I think the executive producers, Gary Marshall and Tom Miller and Ed Milkus, the original exec producers, for picking the people that they did, and they went to pretty great lengths to decide. I remember my screen test. Oh my, it was like running the gauntlet. You know, I mean, I had had several auditions, and then I had to do the screen test, and I was there all day. You know, it wasn't just doing your scene and waiting because there were all the other actors, but then you had to do an improv with somebody, and then they did an interview with you on tape. I mean, they wanted to see you and from so up and down and back and forth, so that, and I guess they were anticipating, you know, how all these people would blend together.
Well, there was no Ralph Melf though at the time, was there?
Not really.
Okay.
You're right. I was screen testing for the role of Potsy, and that's a whole long story, which I will save for another one. But Anson, who originally played Potsy in a previous version of the, they did a pilot that didn't sell, Ron and Anson.
Right.
So anyway, they got cast again after this whole rigmarole of screen tests. But the executives, from what I found out later, my agent said the executives liked your screen test so much that they decided they were going to create a role for you.
How cool is that?
Yeah.
After going through all that, and no, we like this guy so much, he's going to be on. We're going to make it happen.
For him. And there was a small part of a guy, Ralph, in the pilot episode, and they said we'll make that a regular.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Those first couple of years, we were talking a little bit off air about it. Those first couple of years, the way it was filmed, it was just a little bit of a different vibe back then. Very American Graffiti, because it was post that time.
Right. Graffiti came out in 73, and we went on the air. We started shooting. Well, we shot the pilot at the end of 73. And yes, the first two seasons, we were shooting it very much like a movie, one camera. So there were more subtleties in the way, you know, in the way it's filmed, and just the tone of it. It's a lot more a lower key, more realistic kind of tone, like in a movie, as opposed to then what happened was the big successful comedies on TV at the time were in front of an audience, like All in the Family and Maude. So our ratings the first year were good. We were kind of like a minor hit, but not huge.
Right.
And then the second year, the ratings were going down.
Yeah.
And there was a time where they weren't sure if we'd even get picked up. But then I think Jerry Paris, who was our brilliant director, maybe Gary Marshall too, they decided, you know what, maybe this should be a three-camera show to compete with those other ones. And they thought we had a perfect cast for it. Tom Bosley came from theater, you know.
Sure.
He's from Chicago, and then he won the Tony on Broadway,
yes, playing
Fiorello. And Marion had a lot of theater background. Henry had gone to Yale Drama School. I had done, you know, my training in New York was more theater-oriented than film, and Anson had done theater. The one person that was scared the first time we shot, was really scared, was Ron Howard. He had never done any theater.
Andy Griffith was, audience.
And, he had done all these movies, like Music Man as a kid and all this, but no theater. But he did amazing. But that's why they decided, let's turn this and try it out as a three camera. And also moving the character of the Fonz into the forefront more, because his character was becoming so popular. And then that's when we started taking off.
Is that when you knew that this was big? I can't go out in public anymore.
Season, maybe. Somewhere in that third season, we shot up to like number one, you know, in the country, and stayed there for a couple of years, and then two, whatever. But the tone of the show definitely changed. It became, you know, it's this hybrid between live and film.
Yeah.
So when you look back at the episodes, you'll see a distinct difference between those first two seasons and the ones after.
But you think about the ratings at that time, half of America sitting down and watching that. We'll never see that again.
I know. I mean, we were having like 50, 60 million people watching us on a Tuesday night. I know. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And it's fast approaching, and I dare I say like the 50-year mark. I mean, it's coming up soon, you know, 74. So it'll
74
be
74 is when we premiered.
In a few years, yeah. It seems unreal.
Oh, gosh.
That it's become such a big part of TV history. I mean, when people see you guys, and people get excited because that was part of growing up in the 70s.
Yeah, they do, especially like if they see, I'm really good friends. I mean, we're still all friends, but Anson and I have... because we don't live that far from each other, and because of circumstances and whatever, we're probably even better friends now than we were then. I mean, we're just really tight. So when we're out together and people see us together, they get a really big kick.
I bet they do. I bet they do.
Really big kick out of it.
I bet they do. You sang before you even started acting.
Yes.
And at some point on the series, you talked to Gary Marshall and said, okay, Anson's doing some singing. Right. Like, can I throw myself in there and do this?
Yeah, yeah. What happened was, I was singing in nightclubs in the Catskill Mountains when I was 15 years old.
Wow.
And then I put it aside and really focused on acting. And 5 years later, you know, I was on Happy Days. But Anson had done musical theater, and he had approached Gary early on. Early in the first season, it said, and he tells a very funny story in his book, which is called "Singing to a Bulldog," and there's a chapter in it when he convinced Gary to let him. He said, "We should have a band. You know, you have all the other stuff about the 50s. You got the cars, the poodle skirts, all of the stuff going on, but you don't have the music. And we could have a band at Arnold's." And so he convinced Gary to let him try it. And Gary liked it, and, you know, Anson was a good singer, and he had done musical theater. So they did more and more. And then at one point, I took a meeting with Gary because I wanted to, you know, he was lobbying for me to get a chance. But he didn't want to go there because he felt he had already established Anson that Potsy is the singer, and Ralph was more of a cut-up, you know, kind of thought he was a comedian. He didn't want to mess with that. So I didn't really, every once in a while, for the most part I didn't. It was a little frustrating, but I knew one day, it wasn't the music that I really loved anyway. I mean, I liked some of it, but the music that was in my blood were the great jazz standards, you know, great American songbook. And, and I knew I'd want to do that at some point. And I did 5-6 years ago, started putting a show together. Been doing it at clubs in New York.
I know, it gets great reviews, I know.
Yeah, yeah. Studio 54 Below in New York, and jazz out in L.A., Catalina's Jazz Club, and all of that kind of stuff. And then did a CD called Demos, Mostly Swinging, with a great big band. And I just love that kind of stuff.
Very cool. You met your wife on the show.
I did.
Yeah. 35 years now?
We just had our 38th wedding anniversary.
Look at that. Congratulations.
Yes, 38 years. Yeah, she did a guest spot on Happy Days. It was what turned out to be my last season because I did the first 7. And then my contract was up. I opted not to renew. But luckily, Morgan, my wife, was on the show during that last season when we started dating and got married 2 years after.
Look at that.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, wonderful. And then, you know, you get kind of associated with that. And then it was hard for me to even audition for the dramatic parts after that.
Yeah.
You know, that's how things go. But luckily, and it was very hard for a while to get away from being so associated with the character of Ralph. But the one thing about aging, that's another thing from the play.
Put his finger in the air.
Somebody says, name one good thing about aging, you know, and then the character, I won't give you the answer. But for me, it's created more distance from that character as I've gotten older in the time. And I'm now getting to play all kinds of roles that I've always wanted to do. I like playing a wide variety. And I did a movie called MBF, which is on Amazon Prime now, and it's a pretty powerful film, and I play a defense attorney defending a wounded vet. And then I did another one for the same company. We shot in Michigan, actually, right on the other side of this lake, on the very western part of Michigan.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was called Lost Heart, and it's a really nice script. I play a small town pastor in that. And then I did the play Art recently, which is a total departure, again, yeah, from people that would think of me as Ralph.
Here's the good thing, Donnie. You still got it.
I still got it.
You still got it. So thrilled you came into the studio to hang out with us.
Oh, thanks. It was really great talking with you. I totally enjoyed it.
Dave Plyer's radio special, Happy Days at 50, continues.
It's TV legend Henry Winkler. From Emmy Award-winning actor, author, comedian, producer, and director Henry Winkler comes a deeply thoughtful memoir of the lifelong effects of stardom and the struggle to become whole. Henry launched into prominence as the Fonz in the beloved Happy Days, has transcended that role that made him who he is. Brilliant, funny, and widely regarded as the nicest man in Hollywood. It's true, though he would be the first to tell you that it's simply not the case and that he's just grateful to be here. The new book is called Being Henry, where he shares the disheartening truth of his childhood, the difficulties of a life with severe dyslexia, the pressures of a role that takes on a life of his own, and the path forward once your wildest dream seems behind you. Henry has endeared himself to a new generation with roles such as adored shows as Arrested Development, Parks and Recreation, and Barry. And to talk about it all live in the studio is my friend, Henry Winkler. I cannot tell you how great it is to see you in person again.
Nice to see you.
It's so nice to see you, and I can't...
We just flew in from Boston, got off the plane, had Eggs Benedict. I'm now here at the microphone.
Here we are, and happy birthday to you. Another year around the sun for you.
Truly.
Yeah.
I'm very close to now, and you can see I'm very comfortable with it.
I saw you talk to Colbert, ask him what year this was, and you said it was 2023. Which was brilliant, by the way. Keep that low. And did Stacy make you a chocolate bun cake?
No.
Oh.
That is made by a friend of ours.
Oh, nice.
Ricardo. He makes a great bun cake. Stacy usually gets me. There is a bakery in the valley, on Reseda Boulevard, off of Reseda Boulevard, called Bee's Bakery in L.A. One of the best bakeries.
Oh, that's great.
And I have black and white cookies from there.
Oh, nice. Okay.
They're great.
Okay.
Black and white cookies. And she usually has a cake made of a gigantic black and white cookie.
Love
and
that
is my cake.
That is lovely. That is your chocolate guy. For sure, right?
I'm a chocolate guy, but yeah. I'm really enjoying the vanilla side.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thus the black and white. We were talking on the ride over here, like for most people, when they write a book like this, you did it in 9 months. It's like 10 years of therapy, looking back at every facet of your life. And you said, no, it wasn't.
No, it was not. You know, it was I felt the pressure of writing and a book that would entertain and maybe interest. I wrote it with a wonderful man. Now, I've written 39 children's novels with Lynn Oliver. Mm-hmm. So I knew how to work with a partner. And so I met James Kaplan. And I didn't know that I had to fly him out to L.A., put him up twice,
okay,
and feed him 3 times a day.
Wow.
And I want to just say the man is an eater. He's a big eater. okay. I mean, there's got to be a dessert.
Okay. Oh, all right. Okay.
And we talked for, I say, 70 hours.
Wow. And then he just took copious notes. Or did he?
And then he recorded.
He did. Okay.
And then he molded my stories, and I then deconstructed them. There were facts, or there was a joke. Or there were people left out. And so then he would read back to me what he wrote. And then eventually there is a book and it's now out.
It's written very clearly in your voice, though.
Yeah.
And that's what I was telling you. Like, you know, you tell stories, you find connections, you go back to stories. It's almost like having a conversation with you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how I felt.
Thanks.
James Kaplan wrote the ultimate biographies on Sinatra, Irving Berlin. You picked a good guy.
Yeah. Oh, and wonderful man. And very thin. No matter how much he eats, he's still thin. I don't understand it. I keep letting my pants out.
Sure. It's funny. You write very early on in the book, who was I really? That's always been the big question. And it's taken me 50 years to realize that there was a me inside of me.
Yes. Well, that came because I started to talk to a talking doctor, a therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And I have said this many times, but if I were to give this doctor a gift, it would have to be the size of a skyscraper. I so appreciate her. Without saying much, she just kept coaxing me toward answering my own question, finding my true self, which I'm still on the journey of.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a time when I literally was who I thought I should be. And the image just came to me that the bottom of my brain was soldered, shut. You know how when you have coffee or tea and you put a little cream in it?
Mm-hmm.
The cream, like, swirls.
Sure.
And then all of a sudden, the entire cup is filled. My thought, though I know them intellectually, never swirled, never got into the rest of my body.
And you went living like that for
yes.
so long.
Yes, a long, too long. I resent... how much time I wasted being this kind of artifice.
So you almost wish you did that sooner.
I wish I could do it again.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I guess everybody does, but mm-hmm. I wish I had done it sooner because it would have helped me in every area. I could not have been Gene Cousineau 9 years ago. I couldn't have done it with the same texture.
Interesting.
The more you know about yourself, the more you know about everybody, because we are all the same. And I'm just grateful.
But then looking back and writing the book, too, you talk about Gene. I mean, you had so many acting coaches and teachers in your
right.
life. You know, it was a great way to kind of bring them to the screen, right?
And in a few weeks, I'm going to, again, for the third or fourth year, Vulture.com has a big festival mm-hmm. in L.A., mm-hmm. and I hold an acting class.
Oh, that's great.
And I did it here at Northwestern.
Mm-hmm.
I've done it at Emerson College, where I went.
Right, yeah.
I really enjoy that.
Sharing what you learned all these years.
And also having the young actors taste something that they didn't think of in that scene they're showing me or in the monologue. That I won't let them get off the stage until they literally shift in the performance.
And how you become you and how you become an actor started very early on. I mean, 78th and Broadway.
78th and Broadway. My heart is in New York. My body is in L.A. Now, I've been there since 1973,
right.
September 18th. I swear that I think of myself as a transient, even though my children are Los Angelinos, my doggies are Los Angelinos. My wife was born and raised there. Our whole life is there.
Grandkids.
Oh, my goodness, my grandkids. But they are great. But I always think I'm just going back. I'm just here for a minute.
Interesting.
And I'm going back to New York.
Henry Winkler. The book is Being Henry, and there's more with Henry next here on 720 WGN.
1, 2, 3 o'clock.
We're talking to the legendary Henry Winkler. His new book is Being Henry, The Fonz and Beyond. You dig pretty deep into the book, even about your parents' background. Your folks
yes.
came here from Germany right at the beginning,
yes.
or about World War II.
Yes.
They didn't quite understand you. They didn't understand your struggles in school.
Can I just, I have to say this.
Yeah.
It's not a matter of not understanding. I really appreciate that they came to another country, learned another language. He started a business here, my father. We lived above our means. I had a nice life. Here's what I will not let go of. You have a child. That child comes full blown. That child comes who they are. We have a wonderful friend who is a pediatric neurosurgeon. And in the beginning, he thought it was 80% nurture, 20% nature. He now knows, after all these years of practicing, it is 80% nature, and we have a shot at nurturing. They did not see me. They didn't look to see me. They didn't listen. They didn't hear. And I swore I would be a different parent. And, you know, your parents just sit right on your tongue, waiting to come flying out as soon as you're in a familiar situation with your kid. I would say, I'm sorry. It's not what I meant to say. I didn't mean to say it that way. I'm pulling it back. This is what I meant.
It's almost interesting that you say that, because you're watching your parents before you might even have kids, and you're already forming in your brain, I might not do that.
I will not do that.
Yeah.
No.
And you learn good things and you learn bad things.
Yeah. I learned good things out of the house. There are some lessons I took with me.
Yeah.
My father would always say in French, I have no idea if this is right, but that's what I heard, le ton fait la musique, the attitude makes the music.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that
yes.
stuck with me. The attitude.
But sometimes when you're looking back at life, and you're very honest about it, you know, name calling, being yelled at, being grounded, because there was a significant lack of understanding of who you are, who you were, and what
now,
you were doing.
Now, I understand that there was a significant lack in people knowing about dyslexia
right.
at that time.
For sure.
And that's great. I understand that. But you certainly know that something is wrong, as opposed to your child being stupid.
Absolutely.
You certainly know there's something wrong,
absolutely.
Aside from your child being lazy.
Right.
You know, no kid wants to fail. You know what? I'm going to wake up this morning. I'm just going to be an idiot. I think I'm going to fail
right. yeah.
today.
Yeah.
I'm going to get a zero on my math exam.
Right.
That'll make me happy.
Yeah. But I think that gave you the fire in your belly.
It did.
You know?
Well, that gave me the fire, surviving that, and also struggling through dyslexia, not knowing what it was, and then trying to compensate for my lack. That gave me an ability to fight through to get what I wanted.
But you went to Emerson. You went to Yale.
Yeah, but I went to Emerson by the skin of my teeth.
Yeah.
I took geometry in the summer of 1963. If I did not pass it, I would not go to Emerson in Boston, the only college of 28 that I applied to
yeah.
that let me in.
Yeah. But, I mean, even looking at that, Yale, you know, and you said Boston, getting kicked out of acting class, you couldn't memorize your lines.
Well, I thought I could get by on charm. And then I was in the repertory theater at Yale, you know, students got to be in the professional productions, in the professional theater at Yale. And my teacher, Elizabeth, came up to me and literally looked me in the eye and said, if you don't stop kidding around, I'm going to punch your teeth out.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, I think she's serious.
Yeah, right.
Then there was a man, one of the professional actors, in the Buckeye. We were doing the Buckeye. Very important with Andre Gregory was the director. Very long, flowing hair. And I was chewing gum. And he was playing the king. And as he walked by me, he stopped. The procession behind him stopped. He walked up to me and in character said, "You do not chew gum in the presence of the king. You do not chew gum when I am walking by you." And I swallowed the gum. I'm still trying to digest it. And that was in 1970.
But you remember all these people.
I do.
That made an impact. And it's very clear in your book. It's very clear talking to you over the years about it. But it's very clear that there are just people in your life that you knew took you to a different level.
They did.
Yeah.
They did. But and then I was open to listening as opposed to being defensive. I could be very defensive. And then I got to the point where this last season of Barry, Bill Hader directed all of them. Mm-hmm. They all went through his typewriter. And he had great writers around him, Liz Sarnoff. And Bill had a vision. And when he wanted something, he would let you go, but when he wanted something, you didn't say, "You know, I have a different approach, and I'm going to, I'm really thinking artistically." That you mm-hmm. just said, yeah. "Yes, Bill, I'm going to get as close to what you want as I can."
And that's respect. You were on the other side. You done producing directly.
I was now flowering, and becoming more complete. When you're more complete, you don't need to fight so hard. You can just be.
So true.
You know?
Yeah.
And that I think that is the umbrella of the book, is starting where I was who I thought I should be, and I am now getting to who I am. It is such a good feeling.
Henry Winkler, the book is Being Henry, and there's more with Henry next here on 720 WGN. We're talking to the legendary Henry Winkler. His new book is Being Henry, The Fonz and Beyond. You were doing stage, summer stock, improv, doing commercials.
Yes.
A couple of independent films came around.
Yes.
Crazy Joe.
Right.
Lords of Flatbush.
Yes.
Brooklyn, 1950s.
Right.
Sylvester Stallone.
I met this beefy, scary guy who talked out of the side of his mouth, you know. He was like, you know, "Hey, Lee," would look at the people watching us film and say, "I'm going to eat you for breakfast." But inside, he was delicate, articulate, witty, so funny. And he is still a wonderful acquaintance now.
He is. $1,000, 8 weeks of work was what that film was.
Yeah.
And I know you have a great story of Sylvester and Rocky, because you've remained friends for all these years.
Yes.
But when Rocky came around, there was a script that came around to you and gave him some advice.
He finally made it to California.
Yeah.
He comes to California. His car stops on Sunset Boulevard. He calls me. I'm not doing anything. I go. And there he is with his first wife, Sasha. And they have a bull mastiff, which this dog takes up the entire back seat. You need a snorkel in order to get into that back seat with all that slobber. I have never seen anything quite like it.
Okay.
And I thought he was going to really, like, he was going to have me for lunch, that dog. We unpack the car. We lock it. I take him to the apartment. He settles in, calls me up. He says, "I got a script." I take it to ABC. I said, I have a little juice because I'm the Fonz.
Yeah, yeah.
And so at least they will pay attention
yeah, yeah.
to a request.
And a good thing to do for a friend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I also know that I'm not, you know, just doing this for friendship. This guy is a talented man. I give them the script. They buy it. I go back to Sylvester. I say, hey, Sly, good news. Here's your money. Bad news. They want another writer. Henry, don't let them do this to me. Don't. I worked on this. I got to do it. I got to do my own script. I can't have another writer. I go back to ABC. I said, hi, everybody. How are you? Nice to see you. Listen, I really need that script back. Here's all the money. I'll just take the script. Well, we don't do that. No, no, no. I know you don't. I know you don't do that. But there's always a first time.
Yeah.
No, we bought that script. It's ours now. No, that is so true. It is yours now. What I would like is to get it back from you, and then it will be Sylvester's now. And finally, they said yes.
Oh, yeah.
They gave me the script. Yeah. I gave them the money. I gave the script back to Sly. 2 years later, Rocky.
Yeah.
Oh, ABC.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
You had something there.
You had something.
You had something there. Back to 73, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, the Bob Newhart Show. Those were your really first big bounces into television.
What I could do, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, with my first audition. Now, my agent, Joan Scott, who had left New York, and the New York office was in charge. John Kimball was in charge. Joan came out to L.A. to start a satellite company. Office, I should say. And she, when I first came to L.A., when I came right to her office with my suitcase, and she said, don't you want to get a place to live? I said, no. I thought you were going to send me on an audition. Doesn't work that way. You know, it's going to be hard to sell you. It's going to be hard to sell me.
Yeah, nobody wants to hear that.
Are you joking? That is a 3,000-mile, $1,000 mistake I've just made. First audition. I go to CBS Studios in the Valley where they shot Gunsmoke.
Yeah.
The Mary Tyler Moore Show, which was the Friends of that time.
Yeah.
The producer says, I got one line. I don't have a script yet. I said, that's fine. He has a glass of pencils on his desk. I empty. I can do in my professional life what I cannot do in my real life. I empty the glass of pencils, pick up a pencil. While he's talking, we're chatting, I clink the glass and say, excuse me, don't bother yourself. If you get a moment, could I have the salt? Could you pass the salt? By the time I got back to my couch on somebody's in somebody's room at the Sunset Marquee,
sure,
I had the part.
And you said they bounced you around because it was MTM. They would use you again.
Yes, they were very, very, really wonderful. If they found somebody they liked, they brought me in to be just a voice on the microphone in the airport. Talking about, I think, when you know, your plane, if you're on flight 1250, it's gate 32.
You have such a thread of gratitude in you, because there was a reel that was done for Bob Newhart's birthday, and you wished Bob a happy birthday, and you thanked him. For that role.
I did.
You did.
I did.
You remember those things.
I got the Fonz after I did Mary Tyler Moore.
Yeah.
Like a week later, my second week in L.A. And then they came and they asked me, would you do the Bob Newhart Show? And since I had very few lines on Happy Days and I wasn't needed, they allowed me to go and film the Bob Newhart Show.
I know you say I was 27 years old, a short Jew from New York City with a unibrow. And hair down to my shoulders, confidence about next to nothing in my life. The exception was when I was acting, which you just said. But that's when you knew you could soar, when you were acting.
Yes.
Yeah.
I somehow, whatever came into my mind came out of my mouth and my body.
Yeah.
Not so living. Yeah. But I'll tell you, a big lesson that I learned is that when you're anybody who is listening who wants to be an actor, and you go in to audition, they don't want you just to fill time and space, because most of the time they don't exactly know what they're looking for. So you have to show them through your imagination and your fearlessness. There is no right, there is no wrong. You have a 50-50 shot. You're going to get it, you're not going to get it.
Yeah.
Why not throw yourself off the precipice and just see if you can fly?
And sell it.
Yeah.
And sell it. Dave Plyer with Henry Winkler in studio. His new book is Being Henry. Happy Days turns 50.
Yes.
Coming up. American Graffiti, Grease, kind of rocketed to fame. First season, you guys made it to number 16, dropped to the top 30. It was iffy.
It was only iffy, we were almost canceled.
Yeah.
And Gary Marshall had the brilliant idea to go in front of a live audience. Ron Howard had never done that before. He had been in movies or on television since he was 3. He's now 18.
Or single cameras.
Never had done a play.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, I saw wonderfulness. This young man did it in front of a live audience. You would never know he was scared. And it was like a duck to water.
Well, and they were screaming. The audience was screaming just with your presence, walking up to stage, and a lot of the other characters too, but yeah. You, for sure.
Well, the Fonz was very popular. It was really great. It was a wonderful moment in time.
You had a windbreaker. That went away.
You can't be cool. You can't be cool.
Yeah.
Gary Marshall went to ABC and said, you know, if he rides a motorcycle, he could be hyped.
Love your Gary.
You know, they said when he's with his bike.
Yeah.
He can wear leather.
Yeah. And you were a gang all unto yourself. And that's what he was trying to establish there.
Right.
You didn't need other characters to do it. You were a gang all of yourself. Cultural phenomenon. You were right off the bat. Went from a supporting player to one of the stars. The success and that visibility came quickly. I assume it was overwhelming.
You know, it wasn't overwhelming. It was mostly fun. And the reason it wasn't overwhelming is because, for me anyway, there was an emotional component to dyslexia. I believed that I was less than because everybody said I was stupid. So when people would talk to me about how wonderful the character is, how wonderful they thought I was, they couldn't possibly be talking to me. So I just heard the words, and it went through me like a screen door.
This I found interesting, too. You said your parents visited the set, and you said it almost seemed like they were finally proud of me. But the truth is, I didn't care. It was too late. They weren't proud for me. They were proud of me.
Well, they were proud because it enhanced who they were. You know, all of a sudden, they were the co-producers of Henry Winkler.
Right.
You know, I needed them to be the co-producers of Henry Winkler when everything was completely kablooey.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I didn't need them to be proud of me when I figured out how to be successful.
No, and they're your parents, and that kind of messes with your head a little bit.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
But the joy you came out with that show and the people that you worked with and met, Ron and Mary.
Well, they're
Ross.
All still friends. I just saw Don Most.
Yeah.
He now lives in Boulder, Colorado. And our children's book, our 39th children's book, came out like 16 days ago.
Yeah.
Detective Duck.
Yeah.
And I was on tour for The Duck.
Yeah.
And Donnie and his wife, Morgan, live there in Colorado.
Yeah.
And I got to see them.
Yeah.
And it was great.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
A lifelong friendship.
Yeah, lifelong friendships, yes.
But during the time that you were doing it, there were struggles, right? I mean, you know, you talked about in the book, which so many great stories in this book, and we're just touching a few of them here, you got a video cassette recorder in 76. Nobody had a video cassette recorder.
Right. And three-quarter.
Yes.
Three-quarter, remember.
Yeah.
So these are the very biggest tapes.
Massive.
These are professional tapes.
Heavy.
I got it for Christmas.
From ABC.
And other people in the cast got a wallet.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that it was not all equal.
Yeah.
So when I was asked what I got, and they stacked it up against, it was, oh, we are not as respected, then it really hurt a lot of people's
horrible
feelings.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, they wanted to change the name of Happy Days. And I said, look, if I have anything to say, if you're going to listen to me at all, it would be so damaging. I live because of this family. I am successful because I am in the midst of these incredible people. If you change it to Fonzie's Happy Days, years after we have been on the air and it's been Happy Days, it would be such a smack in the face. I don't think I could live with myself.
Best friends, each other's godparents. I mean,
yes.
Close relationships.
Yes.
But you later say that ABC's rudeness turned Ron into a billion-dollar director.
Well,
because he left at some
point. Finally said, you know what? I don't feel as if I have to come back. And he always wanted to be a director.
Yeah.
He talked to me over the years about, do you think I can do this? And knowing Ron, you know there's nothing he can't do.
Yeah.
Except he did tell me that he did open a drawer in his house and there was a mouse and he just closed the drawer and walked away as if nothing had happened. And he let somebody else will take care of that.
Somebody's got that.
I can move a team of 100 people making a movie. Yeah. I'm just going to leave the mouse where it is.
That's great. But I'll tell you, Gary Marshall kept everyone's head straight.
Yes.
By playing softball. It was a thing. It humbled you. It humbled everybody a little bit.
Well, I didn't play sports.
Yeah.
I have no eye-hand coordination.
Right.
I have a Labradoodle named Sadie who has mouth-eye coordination like I have never seen in my life. She must have been on a soccer team.
In a previous life.
Yeah, okay. But she is a better athlete than I have ever been.
We're talking to Henry Winkler. He's in studio. His book is Being Henry, and there's more with Henry next on 720 WGN. Henry Winkler live in studio. His book is Being Henry. Sherry Parrish, Gary Marshall, had you produce or directed Joni Loves Chachi? Was
well,
one of the
that,
first
Eddie Milkus,
yeah.
Tom Miller,
yeah.
And Gary were standing on the street. And they were really intense. And I walked up and I was, you know, hey, guys, how are you? What's going on? We can't find a director for the last episode of Joni Loves Chachi. I said, I'll do it. They went, okay. I said, I was just kidding. I was just joking.
If you don't ask, you don't get.
Yeah, really. But I really wasn't asking. Yeah. I just thought I was being flip. And then I got a red sweater. Jerry Paris wore
Jerry
a
did.
Red sweater every Friday night
yeah.
when we filmed Happy Days. And I got a red sweater, and that was my first directing job.
That's amazing. Amazing. And you directed Memories with Billy Crystal, Smoky Mountain Christmas, produced MacGyver, The Sure Thing.
Smoky Mountain Christmas.
Yeah.
I got to direct the magnificent Dolly Parton,
yeah.
who is just so powerful
yeah.
that you know you can't believe it.
Yeah,
you feel like you're in a windstorm, and she is this lovely, warm, talented singer, songer, musician. She
yeah.
plays, I think, 97
yeah.
instruments.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love her niece, too.
And there's so many great stories in this book, and I want to give them all away. Meeting Paul McCartney, the experience with Robin
yeah,
Williams.
Yeah, now, Paul McCartney, do you think he's listening?
He might.
Because he gave me his phone number. So this is the Henry, the old Henry.
Yeah, yeah.
I meet him in the 70s on the street.
On the street, yeah.
He says, oh, the phones. And I went, oh, my goodness, Paul McCartney. Yeah. He gives me his phone number.
Yeah.
Let's get together.
Yeah.
And like an idiot, I call his phone number every 10 minutes for a day. Never answers the phone, never called me back. So yeah. if he's listening, yeah. by any chance,
call me.
I would just like to say hello again. You know,
oh,
it would
great.
Be it would be fun to like get a ham sandwich together, you know?
A ham sandwich. I love it. Oh, I love it. But the great stories, all great stories in this book. It, but, you know, in the and toward the end of Happy Days, you rejoin Ron Howard in Night Shift. And I will say,
oh, he asked me to be in the movie. First time directing a major motion picture.
Yeah.
He said, Henry, the crew has been doing it for 25 years. I'm only 25. Are they going to listen to me? And he was really nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he is such a powerful being that when he would stop for a minute and say, let me think about that, everybody just got very quiet. And waited for Ron to say what he wanted.
He commands respect. He does.
He commanded
yeah.
respect.
Yeah.
And then he said, you can play either role. And I thought, well, I've been flamboyant for 10 years. So Michael Keaton played Billy Blaze. And really, I played Chuck, who in my mind was Richie.
It was Ron. Yeah. Yeah.
So I got to play Richie, the complete opposite of the Fonz in that, oh, I love that movie.
Which was brilliant for you to do that.
Yeah, it was brilliant, except that people weren't ready for me to be so different. It was like I should have like gradually moved.
But now in retrospect, looking back.
I loved doing that movie.
Absolutely.
Loved every inch of it.
Funny, funny movie.
Yeah.
You have a chapter in the book that starts off, and it's really focused on your lovely wife, Stacey, that I got to meet.
Yeah.
And, you know, almost 50 years of marriage, but it was almost an interview with her in the beginning
right.
of that chapter of how you met. And
right.
you had said, you know, I never saw myself dating someone, marrying someone with another kid. And you kind of explained that whole story and knocking on the door for the first time.
Oh,
it's beautiful.
My God.
It's
well,
beautiful.
You know, I was so crazy about being typecast
yeah.
that I would not call myself Fonzie, be anything Fonzie-esque. I take Stacy out for the very first time. We're going to the movies. I ring the doorbell and I look down and there is this four-year-old who goes, hi, Fonz. And I looked at him in my yeah. Germanic, closed way. I said, my name is Henry. Would you like it if I called you Ralph? And he ran away. Didn't quite get what I was saying. And I thought to myself years later, what a moron.
Was Stacy anywhere in the vicinity?
She was.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. Did you hear about it?
I heard about it yesterday. Okay. And Jed is 52.
Oh, that's great. That's great. But I love that part of the book, for sure. It just touches everyone personally. And I think that's what you said initially, is that's what you wanted people to get out of this book.
Well, you know, here it is. If you get Being Henry from the Fonz and Beyond, I want you to laugh. And I want that I said something in this book, one thing that you go, the reader, you know what? I can use that.
Yeah.
I can use that in my life. That sounds like that makes sense to me. Then I will have done my job. Then I can ride off with my silver bullet like the Lone Ranger.
And I think for me, and I mentioned to the in the car, like for me, it was Henry 2.0, 3.0. Like I'm going through things myself where like, oh, I'm wondering what's next.
Yeah,
in my
but
life.
You know, that is a big lesson
yeah.
that I learned along the way. When I finished the Fonz, I was not being hired for 8 years.
No, a little lost.
So I became a producer.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to be a producer. So here it is. You can accomplish anything if you're willing to just be flexible.
Mm-hmm.
to just put one foot in front of the other and try something you don't know you can do.
Yeah.
And you wind up, wow, that wasn't as bad as I thought. Wasn't as hard as I thought. Now, producing is a hard job, but I thought I would be able to do nothing. And I found what I was good at.
Yeah.
Other people did what they were good at, and I appreciated them, and that's how you got the show on the air.
And you bounce back. And you bounce back to...
You bounce back.
Producing, directing, but back to acting. I remember Larry Sanders' show, Scream. Coach Klein and the Waterboy in a longtime friendship with Adam Sandler.
Adam's brilliant, too. Yeah. See, that's another guy. So personally powerful.
Yeah.
You know, I say this all the time. It doesn't dress well. But you don't mess with him either. You know, but I love him so much. The other night in New York, I was interviewed by Ben Stiller.
Yeah.
And he dialed a number and held the microphone to his phone. And it didn't go through. And he was a little embarrassed and he put the phone down. A little while later, the phone rang.
On stage.
He put the microphone to the phone. And then, where's this guy talking to me like this? I don't know. And I said, are you Jimmy Kimmel's Aunt Chippy? He said, no, it's Adam Sandler. And Adam Sandler called in to wish me well.
I love that.
You know, oh my gosh, it was a great moment.
But these veers into such different roles. Arrested Development, Barry Zuckerkorn.
Yeah.
Hysterical.
Hysterical, but also written. Yeah. Brilliantly well.
Yeah.
You know, if it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage.
Dave Plyer with Henry Winkler in studio. His new book is Being Henry. Barry. Brilliant.
Barry.
Brilliant role for
you. Oh, I'm going to miss it so much.
I know. You won an Emmy. And I just remember you telling me this. You used part of the speech that you intended for Happy Days. When you had your butt in that chair, it didn't get off that chair in the Emmys when you were nominated, and then at the end
you closed.
Well,
if you listen very closely to the announcer, this is Henry Winkler's 1,000th nomination, his first win, you know? Yeah. But it's great. I finally made it into a necklace, and when I'm not, you know, too embarrassed, I wear it. When I'm driving around town, I never am without that Emmy. People say, you know, it's in the bathroom. And I think that they are just full of it.
I think so, too.
You know what I mean? They look at that Emmy and they are really happy.
Really proud.
Yeah.
Yeah, really proud. When you were recognized on the street,
yes.
You've touched so many generations
yes.
and so many iconic roles. You know, it's got to be a variety of things people say
but
to you.
But it's so gratifying.
Right?
And it's all warm. I am never met with anything but warmth. I was met on the streets of New York when Stacy and I were walking back from the theater by this gang of young people. And they backed us up against the building.
Mm-hmm.
And one said, "Hold it. Were you the Fonz?" I said, "Yes, I was." "Hey, Rodney, back up. Give the man some breathing space. Would you like an escort to your hotel, sir?" I mean, it just turned on a dime. It was amazing.
The gentleman that closed your car door when I picked you up.
Yes.
Through the window.
Yes.
Gave you a thumbs up.
Yeah.
He did. It was a young kid. Young kid.
But look, you can also take all of this wonderful stuff. I now get to be the spokesperson for ICANN.
Yes, tell me about that. Yeah, I saw that. Tell me about that.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So Apelles approached me, and my father-in-law was, rest his soul, was my dentist. Tall, big mustache, funny, and unbelievable at what he did. Also loved being in the politics of dentistry.
Mm.
He was an ambassador and traveled all over the country for dentistry. And I literally watched his eyesight deteriorate. He had aging macular degeneration, which then can turn into GA, which is geographic atrophy. And I then get to say, go to your eye doctor. If you're feeling that your eyesight is like off, if straight lines become wavy, if there are spots in the picture you're looking at, you can't see a face, but you see the body, go to your eye doctor. And then there is a wonderful website called gawon'twait.com. gawon'twait.com. You know who called me? Honest to God, 2 weeks ago. Dick Van Dyke.
No.
Has aging macular degeneration. Saw my commercial.
Love that.
Called me up. I'm now talking to Dick Van Dyke on the phone.
I love that you're a fan too. I love
wanting
that.
Wanting to know,
yeah,
do I know something he doesn't about it? Can I lead him? And I said, sir, I am not a doctor. I only play one on TV.
But it's nice to use your celebrity to help other people.
It is. It's important.
Yeah, yeah. You've done that all your career.
Well, especially, I want to say now, in honor of Ed Firstman, my father-in-law, my dentist, who was great and treated me as if the way I wanted my father to have treated me.
Great respect for him for that.
Yes, great.
The great
Henry. And also really pissed me off. He was so tall. He must have had some of my height.
Okay, fair enough.
You know?
Fair enough. The great Henry Winkler, the book is Being Henry the Fonz and Beyond. What a tremendous read. Great picks that I heard you handpicked.
Well, you know, that's the great thing.
Yeah.
If you don't like reading, there are pictures.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You know? Yeah. One of my favorites, aside from the family, is I got to meet Patrick Mahomes.
Yes, yeah, I saw that.
And I went on the field,
yeah,
and this behemoth comes running at me with this big smile.
Yeah.
He said, I have a surprise for you. And he gave me his jersey signed, which I wore in my living room last Super Bowl.
That's fabulous.
And I know that that is one of the reasons they won.
Thank you for all of your time, my friend.
What a pleasure.
I
it's always a pleasure
always.
To chat with you.